Thank you, Mitch, for that very sweet and somewhat abbreviated introduction. I'm especially grateful to you for telling none of those stories. One of these days we have to get together and go over them and forget some of them, okay? The subject I was given peremptorily by Don Lipset is that I was to speak on the ideology of the media. However, I notice that Stanley Rothman is going to be with you tomorrow, and Stanley is the expert on the ideology of the media. And so I have decided to be your expert tonight on the causes of the ideology of the media. It requires less knowledge, which Stanley has, and gives me more leeway, which I can well use. I want to try to figure out with you why the media is what it is. We all know what it is. It's the thing we love to hate. But why it is what it is, why it has that general left liberal ideology, is not so clear. There are some who say that it's just a matter of stupidity on their part. And I can understand how people think that way. Well, you watch Sam Donaldson or Marion Means on television, and you know you are confronted with a rather obstinate C-plus student. It's also true that the kinds of young people these days who go to journalism school are exceeded in their academic ineptitude only by those who go to schools of education. But one wants to be fair. I have many good friends in the media, and it is my honest belief that at least 10% are not at all stupid, maybe even 11%, are really quite intelligent and nevertheless believe things that we find rather stupid for them to believe. And it's a stupidity which seems to be invincible, that is to say, immune to argument. And what I'd like to do is speculate on the causes of this seeming stupidity, which I think one can point to. I'm not sure I've got them all, and that doesn't matter. But I think I've got the main ones. I think one can point to certain technological changes, certain cultural changes, certain sociological changes that have occurred that have made the media what it is today. Rather, I think, to our surprise, since, frankly, 50 years ago, no one would have predicted that the media today would be what it is today. Traditionally, we have had two kinds of journalism in this society. And I think traditionally, up until really the late 1950s, we had two kinds of journalism in all modern democratic societies, Britain, France, Germany. We had the elite publications, the elite magazines, newspapers, and we had the popular, sensationalist, muckraking newspapers. What distinguished them was not only their sobriety of tone, but the perspective from which they looked at the world. Generally, the old elite newspaper, the New York Times of 50 years ago, London Times of 50 years ago, Le Soir 50 years ago, looked at events from the point of view of those with the responsibility for government. That is, they assumed that governing people is very hard, and their function was not only to report what was happening, but also to criticize in as helpful a way as possible the government and the various authorities so that they could perform better. The publication today that still incarnates that perspective is the London Economist. And if you want to get a sense of what the old newspapers were like, I think the London Economist brings you pretty close to it. On the other hand, and at the opposite pole, you had populist sensationalist newspapers, the old Hearst newspapers of 1890s, the Daily Mirror, long lamented of yesteryear. We hate these newspapers when they exist. When they go away, we realize how much we miss them. We New Yorkers dearly would trade the New Daily News for yesteryear's Daily Mirror. That was populist in the sense that, first of all, it was primarily interested in the things that interest people, ordinary people. Sex, murder, fires, scandals of any kind, particularly scandals in high places, which were always more interesting than scandals in low places. But what's interesting is the moral political attitude of populist sensationalist journalism was patriotic to the point of being xenophobic. One must remember the old Hearst Press. That was rather, or the Chicago Tribune of 50 years ago. This was populist journalism, sensationalist, which, you know, in the eyes of those who were educated, seemed to corrupt its readers, corrupt the tastes of its readers, but certainly was not subversive in any other way. And this duality of the two kinds of publications seems to have been characteristic, as I have said, of all democratic societies in Western Europe and in the United States. A rather neat division of labor. And, of course, serious people, studious people, teachers of all kinds, you know, looked forward to the day when the spread of universal education would take the masses and move them away from the populist sensationalist journalism up to the sobriety of elite journalism, which when I went to school, you know, we were badgered to read the New York Times, not the Journal, Hearst Journal American, which had all the comics and good sports pages, that they felt they were doing their civic duty in encouraging us to read the good newspaper rather than the popular newspaper. And the expectation was that with time and education, more and more people would leave the popular newspapers and move up to the elite newspapers. That did not happen for reasons which I'll get into in a moment. Instead, what happened was that the elite newspapers moved down several notches. The first real major change. I'll go back. I may as well stick with this one. The major cultural change that took place was in the 1960s, and it was the convergence of what we used to call highbrow and lowbrow into a new, peculiar, and utterly unanticipated amalgam. Dwight MacDonald coined the term middlebrow, but it's not middlebrow either. It's the Village Voice. I can give you a perfect instance of what it is I have in mind, which somehow or other took over some of the elite, the elite qualities of the older newspapers and debased them, and at the same time took over the sensationalism of the popular newspapers and debased that as well by giving it a quite different political orientation. This new compound which emerged in the course of the 1960s and which is very baffling for still to many of us of a certain age. I mean, Dwight MacDonald, to his dying day, couldn't figure it out. The phenomenon represented by the Village Voice or, say, Rolling Stone, that you could actually have a well-known newspaper man, a nationally known newspaper man, move from the Washington Post, say, to Rolling Stone would have been unimaginable 50 years ago. It's like Arthur Crock leaving the Times and going to work for the Hearst Journal American. It just couldn't happen Nevertheless, that's what Philip Greider did after he did his Stockman story. He left Washington Post, moved to the New York Times. The Rolling Stone, not even the Village Voice, the Rolling Stone. And no one seemed to think this was surprising. He was moving in the same universe. No one thought he had gone to another planet. And in fact, he had not. Or when someone like Seymour Hersh, Seymour Hersh could be on the staff of Rolling Stone, on the staff of the Village Voice. He has been on the staff of the New York Times. I don't know what other staffs he's been on. Maybe the Village Voice, maybe the Rolling Stone, for all I know. Wouldn't matter. No one would be surprised if he moved from one to the other. This new cultural amalgam, which is the, and here Midge is a better analyst of it than I am, of what happened in the 1960s. The highbrow, the old highbrow, elitist, sober perspective, really exists only in the academy today, and even there, not to a very great degree. It has almost vanished from journalism. So, incidentally, has the old populist lowbrow. We don't have any sensational lowbrow newspapers, except maybe for the weeklies, the Star, and what's the other one, the Inquirer. Yeah, which are, as it happens, extremely popular. But that used to be the norm in American journalism. It used to be the common run of American journalism. And, of course, the whole amalgam that has been produced by this wedding of highbrow and lowbrow, this peculiar wedding, is one in which the political point of view has radically changed and has radically moved to the left. And this is a cultural phenomenon. It has to do with the shift that occurred in the culture as a whole and in the popular culture. When popular songs moved left, as they did in the course of the 1960s, when the movies began to move left, as they did in the course of the 1960s, one could see what was happening, because these traditionally had been the homes of the pious, traditional American virtues. And it's a mystery to me exactly how it happened. It's a mystery to me exactly why it happened. It has something to do, certainly, with the advent of mass higher education after World War II. Certainly. Well, it's, after all, you... In order to read the Village Voice, you do need at least a couple of years of college. Or else you have to be really quite intelligent. It is not an easy thing to read. I find it unreadable. The articles are very long. You need a lot of patience to sit down and read that publication. The expansion of higher education after World War II created a lot of what someone has called demi-intellectuals. That is to say, people sufficiently well-educated to read the Village Voice or Rolling Stone, who took rock music seriously, and who had absorbed in their colleges and on their campuses what Lionel Trilling has called the old avant-garde adversary culture, but in a thoroughly vulgarized and debased way. The old avant-garde culture was a culture of producers. The new avant-garde culture is the debased version of that culture. The counterculture, as we call it, is a culture of consumers. One used to be a bohemian in order to pose as a producer. Now one, it becomes a bohemian to pose as a consumer of certain kinds of cultural products. And, of course, there are always more consumers than there are producers. Consequence was a vast new audience created for these cultural attitudes, which gradually subverted both the older lowbrow and the older highbrow. The older lowbrow periodicals and newspapers folded one after the other, whereas the older serious newspapers began to lower their standards year by year in an effort to become more popular and, of course, at the same time, assume the attitudes of this new class of writers and readers reflecting this new counterculture. I think the point at which one could say the whole process had come to a triumphal conclusion was when Neil Sheehan and the New York Times received their Pulitzer Prize for publishing the Pentagon Papers. I mean, this was the first time in the history of modern journalism that a newspaper received a Pulitzer Prize for nothing that any journalist had written. They received a Pulitzer Prize for publishing stolen documents. But since these stolen documents were then, I think quite dishonestly, reported as casting doubt on the integrity of the government, it was deemed worthy of a Pulitzer Prize. And now, Arnold Weitzman mentioned this ABC nuclear program that's coming on next Sunday, and he referred to an interview with a producer and said, where did he get his ideas from? The answer is, who works on CBS and NBC newsrooms? Where do they get their young writers from? I mean, they're not famous journalists. If you're a famous journalist, you don't go to work for CBS or NBC. Newsroom, those are donkey jobs, even though they may be rather well paid. They all come from the Village Voice or from Rolling Stone or from some such place. If you read the professional journals of the media, the Columbia Journalism Review, you see the constant flow of people from these newspapers reflecting these attitudes into all the old established and newer established publications, Time, Newsweek, with the consequence that by now the set of ideological attitudes associated with the counterculture simply pervades the entire journalistic media. They are not biased. I mean, it's important to understand. People who accuse the media of bias do not understand the media. The media is not biased. The media is objective. It believes that everything it is reporting and saying is the objective truth. And they genuinely are distressed and perplexed when you accuse them of bias. They believe that their views represent objective reality. And there's no point in giving them lectures on relativism. They'll probably end up agreeing with you on that, because they too have children. They too have to instill into those children some sense of absolute values. But the fact is, by now, that culture, which has infused our popular music, our academic studies, at all levels, is so powerful that they believe that they are seeing the world truly, and that others who do not see the world in this way are suffering from a distortion, either due to ineptitude or to the influence of vested interests. So the cultural revolution, which, as I say, emerges with the spread of higher education after... I shouldn't say higher education, I hate that phrase. With the spread of higher schooling after World War II. I mean, schooling and education really should be distinguished from one another. With the spread of higher schooling after World War II, this possesses both traditional forms of journalism in favor of a new, still not adequately comprehended or adequately analyzed compound. The other, a second cause of the ideology of the media is purely technological. And it involves the advent, again, after World War II, of television. Television is inherently a sensationalist medium. Inherently. The camera is inherently a sensationalist medium. It can't do anything with serious thinking. You cannot watch a person think seriously on television. You can't even listen very well to a person talk seriously on television because after 5 minutes it becomes boring. That's the nature of television. It is inherently sensationalist and therefore Its solemnity takes the form of simply a brief, platitudinous exposition of left liberal attitudes that they have acquired from the youth, from the popular culture, from their schooling. Now, that in itself perhaps would not be so bad. One could live with it. Though it really, well, it is too bad. I mean, there's no question that this is one of those cases where technology worked against human progress and human reason, namely where technology elevated into journalistic discourse a simply inferior mode of exposition. As my editor at Commentary back in the days when Midge and I were both there, Elliot E. Cohn, used to say, one word is worth 1,000 pictures. And, you know, if you're interested in reasoning, if you're interested in rational analysis, that is true. On the other hand, pictures are interesting to look at. No one can deny that. So that television, insofar as it was journalistic, inevitably leaned toward a combination of sensationalism, which is simply congenitally congenial to it, with a pious assumption of the kinds of attitudes and views to be found in, I would have said to be found in Rolling Stone or Village Voice, but they're now to be found in the New York Times or the Los Angeles Times or 25 other so-called respectable newspapers throughout, well, not so-called, perfectly respectable newspapers throughout the land. But worse followed. And this is that because television is such a potent instrument, not of persuasion, I don't believe that for a moment, but because its audience is so huge and its attractiveness to advertisers so great, all newspapers felt compelled to compete with television. And as a consequence, there was an added because of the necessity of competing with television, papers that really didn't particularly want to become more sensationalist, more muckraking. I don't think the New York Times really did. Simply was forced to. These papers had no choice because they were losing readership. The readers were getting trained by their viewing on television to expect a certain kind of journalism. And thus there emerged the peculiar beast which we now call the media. What do we mean by the media? I think we have to be very clear about that. The media does not consist of everything that is published in the United States and does not consist of everything that is broadcast in the United States. The media has 7 partners, and that's the media. It consists of the 3 networks, Washington Post, New York Times, Time Magazine, and Newsweek. That's the media. The rest, everyone goes around. When I discussed this matter with journalists, they said, well, you don't know how conservative some of the local papers are. The local papers don't matter. Even the local radio stations don't matter. These 7 sisters, as it were, establish what legitimate journalism is in this country. They decide. If you are editing a small-town newspaper, no matter how conservative you are, if the top story on CBS is such and such, and the top story on NBC is such and such, and on ABC, and if it's on the cover of Time and Newsweek, and on the front page of the New York Times and the Washington Post, there is no way you are not going to regard that as that day's story. I mean, if they decide that something that Mr. James Watt said, James Watt, what's his name? The late Mr. Watt. James Watt. Yeah, he was an inventor, wasn't he? James Watt, right. Didn't sound right. If you happen not to think that a casual remark by Mr. Watt is worth a front page story, you are nevertheless going to have to be forced to make a front page story, or else everyone will think you're a bit crazy. How can the 3 networks, the 2 major newspapers, plus Time and Newsweek, do it, and you seem to be oblivious to what they are doing? You cannot. That's what the media is. those seven sisters are the dominant force in communications and journalism in the United States today. And they interact among one another, thereby reinforcing their own attitudes. The people who work on the newspapers watch the news programs of the networks. The people who work on the networks, what do they read? Assuming they read something, they do. I mean, they do read. They read the New York Times, they read the Washington Post, they read Time and Newsweek, and then they go to work. And that's what they know. If you go to NBC and you say, let's look at the file on something, out comes the New York Times, Washington Post, Time and Newsweek. I mean, that's research. The little girls, these days the little boys, sitting there clipping out those stories. So for their, quote, library, unquote. The consequence is that they are truly astonished to discover that there are people out there who don't see things their way. And they must come to the conclusion that there's something very odd about you or me. That they are the normal. I mean, they are the norm. I mean, how could they all be wrong? And that those who criticize the media either have a special interest or are simply out of touch with reality. That's all. And therefore, they are very self-righteous, very moralistic, very arrogant, because they know, as a result of speaking to one another and reading one another, just how right and perceptive their views are. The third cause is sociological, and in a way results from the confluence of the Cultural Revolution, which produced and popularized a set of attitudes, and the Technological Revolution, which focused, and this is so important to realize, which focused journalistic influence in those seven sisters. I'm sure many of you have seen Thornton Wilder's Our Town, and I assume many of you at one time or another probably even acted in it. What paper did they read then? I mean, that was America, Our Town. They read a local paper. I mean, no one out in that little Our Town read the New York Times. I mean, I can remember the New York Times was read in New York, period. No one ever read the New York Times elsewhere. No one paid any attention to the New York Times. No, the Washington Post didn't exist except as a local paper until well after World War II. And most of America was immune to their views or their influence. It's the coming together of these new cultural attitudes, plus the arrival of television and the wedding of the networks to, and I guess not only the networks, it may even be cable TV, I don't know, because whom do the cable television people hire? They hire Dan Shore, you know, the people who for some reason are no longer at home in the networks. Because they have, quote, experience, unquote. This combination of cultural trends and technological innovation conspire to give the profession of journalism, and I use the word profession with considerable reserve, new status and new power. There really isn't been nothing like it in the history of the world, and it's not easy to figure out what terms even to use. It's a kind of anti-democratic populism. An anti-democratic pseudo-populism, I think, would even be a better way of describing what the media is doing. The media speaks, and this is what I'm talking, the seven sisters. The media speaks for the people. They believe they speak for the people. They assure you they speak for the people. They intend to speak for the people. And if the people seem not to be speaking the way they should be speaking, then the people are a bit laggard and will come around, must come around. They really have a sense of themselves as an kind of incipient aristocracy. It's a peculiar term to use, but I really can't think of any other, the people of the media. I mean, they think of themselves as a class entitled to special respect, special perquisites, special privileges. And, you know, if they are omitted from an invasion, then you know, that makes the invasion per se illegitimate. I mean, this is, you know, one of the estates of the realm has had its rights violated by being ignored at a time of interesting developments. In a democracy, you always get emerging oligarchical impulses and emerging aristocratic impulses. This, I think, is normal. And the founding fathers would not have found it anything odd about my saying that it's normal. That's why they created the system that they did, precisely to constantly disintegrate such impulses. One sees the oligarchical impulse, which, despite the fact that a lot of people make a lot of noise about it, especially the media, and which is normal to a capitalist society, the oligarchical impulse is very clear within the business community. And I find it amusing to discuss this with CEOs of corporations, particularly the major corporations, who really, they're not greedy. But every CEO who spent 7 years working 12, 14 hours a day running a major corporation feels not that he should retire on a generous pension, but that he should retire with, let's say, $4 or $5 million in capital so that he can pass that on to his children, so that he feels entitled to an estate. They all do, which is one of the reasons you get what are, in fact, some rather outrageous and self-rewarding activities within corporations involving stock options, golden parachutes, and so on. I mean, they really do feel entitled, not just to a pension, no matter how generous, but to an estate. They don't know it. I mean, and they are, you know, the most unassuming oligarchy you could hope to meet. All they want to do is retire and go out and play golf. But nevertheless, they want to play golf at a very expensive golf course. And they want to be able to afford to go to Europe frequently or go around the world and perhaps have an apartment in New York or London or wherever. It's normal. And similarly with every such group in a democratic society, you get a natural impulse to become something more than democratic. And this is true of academia, where all professors really feel that they are uncommon men and women, and they're perfectly willing to represent common men and women, to speak for them and stand up for them and govern them, but they don't think they ought to be treated like common men and women. And the same thing is true of journalists. Journalists have become a class in our society who regard themselves as a kind of nobility at war with the centralized authority, trying to limit its power and disperse its power so that they could get a share of it. They use democratic rhetoric in the course of their work, accusing the government of being anti-democratic and the like, but then everyone uses democratic rhetoric today, including, of course, the Soviet Union, the Chinese People's Republic, et cetera, et cetera. No one, since Hitler at least, goes around saying he's anti-democratic or non-democratic. So the fact that they use democratic rhetoric is, of course, quite beside the point. But the journalistic core does feel that it should have influence in government and the business community should not. It even has come to wonder about trade unions, one of the more interesting developments in the past several years, the fact that the media has lost a sympathy that was rather evident in the 1930s and 40s with regard to trade unions. They don't like trade unions. They would prefer, they regard trade unions as a threat to their influence and power. They want government that is responsive to the people, as represented by the press corps. And that is their conception of democracy. And so you have a sociological phenomenon of really a class with class ambitions for power, class ambitions for status, class ambitions for influence. And where it will all end, at the moment it's hard to say, but the future of this society and of this American democracy, given the nature of the media and the state of the media and the objectives of the media, well, the future becomes somewhat darker than it need be. However, one of the nice things about a free society is that it's always surprising you and manages somehow to domesticate all of the menaces it gives rise to, manages to unman the enemies it has sired. And my own view is that this phenomenon we call the media, which at the moment indeed is adversary to our democracy and to the survival of our democracy. Doesn't like capitalism, doesn't like the business community, which has far too much influence it thinks it should have. It doesn't like government unless government is absolutely toadying toward the media. The only government that likes is the government that goes out of its way to toady up to the media. And even then, it then double-crosses the government and brings it down. I mean, look what they did to poor Jimmy Carter. They have to show their power occasionally, and the only way this new class can show its power is by destroying something occasionally, which is a pretty good way of showing power. Nevertheless, I do think the future of this democracy and of the media in this democracy is not as bleak as this analysis would have us think. I mean, one of the problems with these kinds of quasi-sociological analyses is they look so cogent, you know, until you, the breath of reality comes along and suddenly it's all gone. Things are happening and will happen. I'll point to a couple of the things that have happened. The Grenada incident was very interesting, because this was one of the most dramatic cases where the media was shocked to discover it had completely misread the reality. You must understand that when this thing happened, practically every member of the Washington press corps thought the American people would be opposed to the Grenada invasion. And they were astonished to discover that this was not the case. They just kept talking Vietnam. I mean, they simply don't understand. For one thing, it's a generational problem. I mean, the Vietnam generation, or perhaps I should say the anti-Vietnam generation, now dominates the media. But of course, the world now is full of young Americans who don't remember anything about Vietnam, who, when you talk to them about Vietnam, take notes. And when you talk to them about the 1960s, they ask you to spell every name. The media was astonished and truly shaken to its roots to discover how wrong it was on Grenada. Now, mind you, that's one little incident. And it quickly recovered its composure and dropped the CBS poll into the pit somewhere and went on to discuss learnedly on international law. But nevertheless, it cannot stand too many of those shocks. And I am hoping, of course, it all depends on politics, but it seems to me that the Reagan administration, having tasted blood, might decide to drink a bit more. A few more such shocks to the media, and they will become disoriented. And since in the end, they are commercial enterprises. Everyone forgets that. But in the end, they are commercial enterprises. They will somehow, I don't know how, somehow there will be some responsiveness there. There must be, I think. I don't see how there could not be. In addition, as I've just mentioned, there is a new generation that has emerged. And the best news, in fact, it's so good I don't believe it, but I'm assured it's absolutely true. I just learned today at lunch. Apparently, there was a poll some weeks ago at Dartmouth on the 1984 forthcoming presidential election pitting Mr. Reagan against Glenn and or Mondale. Now, Dartmouth, you must remember, in 1980 voted overwhelmingly for John Anderson, the student body, that is. Faculty probably voted further left, but the students voted overwhelmingly for John Anderson. In the latest poll, which apparently included something like 570 students out of a not huge student body, so it was a very good random sample, they say, Mr. Reagan actually won at Dartmouth, which is one of the most radical of the Ivy League colleges. And as I just learned this today at lunch. I'll have to investigate it. But the people who gave me this, apparently the poll, by the way, was conducted by the Young Democrats on campus, who announced the results. I must say, good students. They presented their findings, even though they didn't like them. So apparently it's a poll to be believed. Now, if that can be true on the Dartmouth campus, it can show that, in the end, a culture that is out of touch with reality can slowly lose its credibility. Or perhaps perceptions of reality change. I really don't know. I'm not exactly au courant with what's happening among young people these days. But it does seem to be the case that the trend over the past 10 years among the young cohorts, as the sociologists call them, as they move into high school, move into college, does suggest a certain immunity to the impact of journalism. Why they are immune, I don't know. Maybe they watch so much television when they're young that they simply think that Dan Rather is Captain Kangaroo and therefore not to be taken seriously. It may be. I mean, you do get this peculiar self-inoculation in a democratic society. But that does seem to be happening. Despite, all of our genuine fears and alarms about the media, and despite the grief it causes us, it nevertheless seems to be the case. An awful lot of young people are emerging who are, for some reason, not all that influenced by them. In the end, of course, it's possible that the people now in the media will change. They'll grow older, and that's always very good. They'll come battle-scarred. Children will say will badmouth them. They'll go to the dentist more often. I mean, all sorts of ghastly things will happen to them. And probably that, their jowls will begin to sag and they'll be thrown off television. Mr. Cronkite was the exception. Most television commentators and journalists of that kind really don't last that long. They have to. Though maybe the government will insist that they stay on, because otherwise it would be discrimination against the aged. But at that point, I have a feeling people will not be watching those programs very much. It would be nice to. What I would like to conclude with is a good, pompous statement on the necessity of educating our masters. And the media are now, in a sense, one of our masters. And it would be nice to educate them. And one wishes to educate them. They must be educated. On the other hand, as a teacher, I have never been able to find out how to educate someone who thinks he knows it all. The motivation is lacking. And the efforts we have made to bring education into schools of journalism have all failed dismally. So I don't know how to educate our masters, but I'll nevertheless end with that nice pompous note that in the future we must devote more of our energies to educating these new untutored masters of ours so that they can live with us at peace in this American society. Thank you.